From NPR and WBUR, I'm Celeste Headlee in Washington, D.C.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. It's Here and Now. Senators are trying to finalize a deal this week on a gun safety bill to hold a vote before the July 4th recess. But attendees at the Texas State Republican Convention this weekend were having none of it. They booed one of the main negotiators, Republican Senator John Cornyn.
We fought and kept President Biden's gun-grabbing wish list off the table.
The plan Senator Cornyn is negotiating would expand background checks for people between 18 and 21 who want to buy a gun and give incentives to states to pass so-called red flag laws to take guns from potentially dangerous people. It would also increase funding for mental health and school safety. So what do educators think of the plan? Becky Pringle is the president of the National Education Association, representing 3 million educators. She's also a former teacher. Welcome, Becky.
Thank you, Celeste. It's good to be with you.
So this proposal does have a lot in it that's specific to schools. What do you make of it?
It does. And we're certainly encouraged that it's a bipartisan framework, that it addresses many of the issues that we've been talking about. You know, all we're asking for our students is to stay safe. All of them deserve that, whether they're in schools or in their communities, is a comprehensive, common sense gun laws that the majority of Americans support. So that the framework includes background checks for those under 21. It includes the extreme risk protection, the red flags, that it also includes fighting firearm trafficking across states, as well as closing the boyfriend, quote unquote, boyfriend loophole. And does talk about supporting mental health access. Those are all really, really, really critical first steps and represent the most significant progress in halting the epidemic of gun violence in this country that we've seen in decades. So we're awaiting the details because it's just a framework, yeah. So we don't know for sure. We're urging them to get it into a bill and pass it as soon as possible.
What's missing that you would like to see in there?
So a couple of things. First of all, the red flag laws, we're really, really, really thankful that that's in there. But they do push it to the states to do it. And we have consistently talked about not only states, but also the federal government having that in legislation that protects everyone. We have been calling for the ban on assault rifles forever. The ability for one person to take so many lives in minutes, just unacceptable. Unacceptable. So we absolutely will continue to fight for that. And, you know, those high capacity feeding devices, yeah. and those kinds of things that are weapons of war. That's what they are. Ending the gun industry's special legal protections. There are still some loopholes that need to be addressed. As far as we know, the framework doesn't have anything in it about safe storage laws. So there are some things they still need to do, but this is a good first step.
So Ohio's governor recently signed a bill that would allow schools to decide whether their employees should arm themselves if they go through 24 hours of training. What do you say to the idea of allowing teachers to carry weapons?
So we already know what works and what doesn't. In, I think it was 2013, Texas passed a similar law. You know, that's been almost a decade. And in that time, only a little over 360 teachers took them up on that. We have 9,000 campuses. We have almost 370,000 teachers. 300? Yeah, that's not solving anything. It's a distraction to prevent members of Congress from focusing on the kinds of gun laws we actually need. So that's the way we look at it. And additionally, honestly, Celeste, you know, I think about my time in front of middle-level learners, those babies with attitude. I love them. And I'm trying to imagine me having the responsibility, even if it's voluntary, for me to feel that weight and pressure on my shoulders when my job is to teach and nurture and help create a space that's conducive to good teaching and learning. And I'm expected to carry a revolver and keep it safe and get it out in time and stop an assault rifle. No, no. Not only is it not practical, it is unconscionable that we would put that weight on teachers.
What are your concerns, though, as these proposals continue to come up, not only to arm teachers, but to increase the police presence on campuses, to add extra security? We do have research that shows that putting more police officers on school campuses ends up putting Black and brown students at greater risk, sometimes of being expelled or entering the school-to-prison pipeline. Are you concerned about that?
Absolutely. We do have evidence, and we've had it for decades, that our Black and brown students are disproportionately impacted by police violence, not just in schools, but in neighborhoods. We know that. We at the NEA have been working very hard to, in fact, use some of the American Rescue Plan money to bring to our schools restorative practices and other ways of addressing some of the issues that find their way to our schoolhouse doors. But we know that, and this is, you know, Celeste, when they use the word hardening schools, what does that sound like? I mean, they use those words as though that's making us feel better. No, that's not making us feel better. It's scaring the students and the educators. And the idea of thinking that you can prevent an assault rifle by hardening that school enough is ridiculous. And we know that making schools into prisons is not the way, it's just not the way to go. Now, of course, we need to take common sense measures to keep, to have safe schools, but we have to address the issues around disparity that you raised. We have to address the fact that we want environments where our students want to come and learn and where they'll thrive and be creative, not a prison.
Becky Pringle is the president of the National Education Association. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Celeste. Stay safe.
You too.
Thanks.
Well, we don't have to tell you that food is more expensive these days, and there are plenty of reasons why, but two crops play an outsized role: corn and soybeans, ingredients in most of the foods Americans eat. As KCUR's Frank Morris reports, those two commodities now cost double what they did just 2 years ago.
High food prices fall hard on people like Leah Morning, looking for a deal on pancake mix in a Kansas City grocery store.
I have a three-month-old. I'm so glad that I don't have to worry about food for her right now, because how the hell are you supposed to feed your kids when pancake mix is $3.65 when it's normally like $2-something?
This pancake mix, like most of what Morning is shopping for today, contains corn. And Richard Volpe, an agricultural economist at California Polytechnic State University, says that's to be expected. Corn is everywhere.
Corn is, in my view, unquestionably the foundational commodity to the U.S. food supply chain. There's nothing more important than corn.
Volpe says that corn is a component, directly or indirectly, in at least three-quarters of the food and beverages here. Well, take the meat counter over here.
Most of those animals were fed with corn, meaning that the price of corn is going to be directly correlated to the cost of raising and slaughtering and processing those animals.
Milk, cheese, butter too. Dairy cows eat corn. And those eggs you eat come from corn-eating chickens. Up and down the aisles in the middle part of a traditional grocery store, past condiments, sodas, and mixes, Volpe says most packages contain at least a little something made with corn.
Corn syrup's the big one, but corn flour, corn meal, it pops up in many, many, many foods, beverages, nearly everything that's perishable, shelf-stable, corn's in a lot of them. That's why corn is so important.
And the price of corn is way up.
That Russian invasion of Ukraine has taken what was already a market that was rising and has just kicked it into overdrive, has driven up prices.
That's Scott Richmond, chief economist with the Renewable Fuels Association. He says corn was rising on concerns about growing conditions before Russia attacked Ukraine. The war pushed corn prices into near record territory. And you can see that outside the grocery store, too, here at the gas pump.
It's hard out here.
Kish Magal is buying 1.5 gallons of gasoline. 10% of that is ethanol, so more corn.
Too high, you see $7. Ain't got none.
So corn's just about inescapable. And Bruce Babcock at the University of California, Riverside, says soybeans are huge too.
Really, corn and soybean oil, soybean meal are everywhere, ubiquitous in our food supply. The only place they're not really in our food supply is fruits and vegetables. But everything else has corn and soybeans.
Soybeans are up even more than corn. And today's crop prices can take months to show up at the grocery store. So the effect of high corn soybean prices will linger well into next year. But the good news? Corn and soybeans still make up a tiny percentage of the total cost of processed foods. Again, Bruce Babcock.
The price you pay, that consumers pay at the retail, is more having to do with the price of the cost of labor, the cost of shipping, the cost of manufacturing, the profit margins up and down the supply chain.
In fact, for every dollar Americans spend on food, less than a dime goes to farmers. So while high corn and soybean prices drive up the cost of most foods, those dietary staples are still just a sliver of the overall grocery bill. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris.
Australian filmmaker Baz Luhrmann makes big movies, think Moulin Rouge. Well, his new film Elvis is also phantasmagoric, but then again, so was Elvis, right? Best-selling solo artist of all time, born in poverty in Tupelo, Mississippi, grew up in a segregated black community, got religion in a black revival tent, got a start in Memphis. In the film, he's played with ecstatic fervor by Austin Butler. Those who are now rolling their eyes and saying, wasn't Elvis some guy my great-grandma liked in the 1950s, or maybe on the wrong side of the rock and roll culture chasm in the 60s? Well, Baz Luhrmann reclaims Elvis as a groundbreaking, cool musician who didn't co-opt black music like the Rolling Stones did, but actually lived it. That thing he was supposed to have said about black people? Historians say he didn't. We'll get to that. Well, what else did Baz Luhrmann want to say about Elvis and his Svengali-like manager Tom Parker, played by Tom Hanks? Let's ask. Baz Luhrmann, welcome.
Very happy to be talking to you, Robin.
Well, taking on an American myth, though, you know, Elvis still revered and mocked.
Yeah, sure.
Did you have any fear of not getting it right?
Paradoxically, I'm always fearful. And on the other hand, I'm like, well, I'm the ultimate outsider. I mean, I was in Graceland last few days, and I realized it was 5 years ago that I first went down there and started not just researching it academically with a team, but living it. I just thought it was such a great canvas on which to explore America in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Yeah. And that's what drew me to it.
Is it true that you got into Elvis's bedroom? You actually saw the thing that no one's ever seen, and that's accurately reproduced in the film?
It's a very sensitive issue, particularly for Lisa Marie.
His daughter, yeah.
Yes. I certainly didn't do any recordings, and I wasn't able to do any photos, but I was able to use my mind to get enough information to reproduce that space. Yeah.
You're touching on something. I mean, it is sacred. Why did you want to do Elvis?
I think I love a film like Amadeus. Is it about Mozart? A bit. But it's equally about Salieri. And what it's really about is jealousy. Now, if you want to look at America in the 50s and 60s and the 70s, and you want us to look at where we are now, a great go-to place is The Life of Elvis Presley. But as well as that, the film is shared by this other gigantuan character, Colonel Tom Parker and Tom Hanks. And really, it's the tension between the cell and the soul. You know, what's so great about America is that it's such a potpourri of possibilities and invents new things, but it also sells very well. But when selling gets out of control, then it destroys the soul. And that's really the underlying gesture of the movie. Plus, it's an extraordinary life. I didn't know it would be when I started researching and living it, but Elvis Presley lives the most extraordinary, almost operatic life in his short 42 years.
Yeah. It's funny because Maureen Dowd in her New York Times piece on you quoted one of your actors saying that you are a walking opera. You know, that this kind of extravagance is something that would appeal to you. But what you also get across is that at heart, Elvis was a very spiritual young man. And so let me ask you one of the questions that's been a criticism. You mentioned Colonel Parker. Why make this guy, who's seen as the evil character who plies Elvis with drugs, traps him in a deal in Las Vegas to pay off Parker's own gambling debts, doesn't let him make a film with Barbara Streisand, who wouldn't, I mean, it's painful to even
hear
that.
That, Robin, that's his greatest sin, is not letting Elvis be in Star Wars. You know, Robin, honestly, when Elvis dies, the colonel is informed. And he picks up the phone and he says, print more records. That's the first thing he does. Now, we would all go, what a cold-hearted person. But he would go, no, no, you wanted the records. Like, I'm there to keep you and Elvis together. You wanted Elvis to do two shows a day. You wanted more Elvis. You wanted him to be a god. I just facilitated your love for him and his love for you.
Putting that aside, though, just another thought that I want you to address, which is speaking to Black Americans who are wary. And I mentioned that I'd seen the film to a Black dear friend, and she said, I'll never forgive Elvis for that racist thing he said. Now, he never said this thing that many Black Americans think he said. That is that Elvis said the only thing a Black man, although he is said not to have used that word, is good for is shining my shoes and buying my records. Now, again, he never said that. But you went further than just researching that quote. What else did you find?
My findings, very simple. No American Black music, no Elvis, no doubt about it. But I think some of the artists in my film, like Yola, who plays Sister Rosetta Tharpe, the godmother of rock and roll, the real inventor, actually, who's, by the way, not celebrated enough, or Eve Kelvin Harrison Jr., who's playing B.B. King, Elvis's friend. I mean, they had to do their research. Is the one thing about cultural appropriation, and Yola said it so eloquently the other night. She said, you know, the appropriation is when you go bang. There was no lineage. You know, you'd sort of say they invented it. But actually, what I tried to do was show Elvis's journey. You know, he grows up in the Black community. In the 50s, he was a rebel. Mm. It was dangerous to be singing and associating with Black artists. Mm. But one thing is certain, working with Nelson George, one of the preeminent Black music historians, you know, he worked with me on The Get Down. I said, go out there and prove it, you know. And Nelson wrote a critical book on Elvis in the 80s. And what you find is actually the lineage is there. Mm. Famously, Elvis says, I am not the king of rock and roll. And then he points to Fats Domino, who's in the audience, and says, come here, Fats. This is the real king of rock and roll. And well, when I found Sam Bell, it was a revelation because he was a childhood friend.
Yeah, you found his childhood friend that he grew up with in this Black segregated neighborhood who recently passed, but he also verified some of this. Another misconception, you know, people of a certain age think of him as a Halloween costume, you know, a kind of a square, certainly in the late 60s. We see him anew as like a punk rocker before David Bowie, an eyeliner and hair dye.
Yeah. Funny you mentioned David Bowie, a friend of mine. Almost all musicians, in one way or another, were influenced by Elvis. In fact, David was indeed too. There are three Elvises. There's the 50s Elvis, which is, he really is the first punk. If you actually hear the screaming, the growling of the audience, the sound itself, but also this fluidity in his style. He's wearing crop tops and makeup. And Priscilla told me only the other night about how he put eyeliner on very early, learning about Tony Curtis, you know. So you've got that. And then you've got in the 60s, when the colonel is trying to isolate him from rock and roll and Black music and culture, he puts him into Hollywood and he's in a Hollywood bubble. And then in what we call the 68 special, Elvis gets back to his roots and his singular great love gospel. I mean, that's why he's up with the Sweet Inspirations singing to six in the morning gospel with them. So you're right. He's either for a certain generation, he's either a Halloween costume or he's in Lilo or Stitch. And then for some people of a certain age, he's like maybe a god. And he's kind of neither of those things. What he is what Austin Butler has revealed. He's a very, very vulnerable human being.
Oh, Austin Butler, that's him singing in the most of the film.
Yeah, you're right, Robin. In fact, the reaction of Lisa Marie, she's been through incredible pain recently, and I didn't know how she would react. She said, I've seen the film twice, and the first time I thought it was my father singing. Didn't realize it was actually Austin. Come back, baby, come. Come back, baby, come. Come back, baby, I won't wait. Well, listen, I'll tell you, baby, what I'm talking about.
By the way, Basil Ehrman, just want to mention that, of course, you are not new to the recording industry. You have your own label. You had a hit.
Wear sunscreen. If I could offer you only one tip for the future.
We're referring, sunscreen, of course, to the 1997 hit single, Everyone's Free to Wear Sunscreen, based on the advice by late, great Chicago Tribune columnist Mary Smitch. This was an address she gave to graduates.
Enjoy your body. Use it every way you can. Don't be afraid of it or what other people think of it. It's the greatest instrument you'll ever own.
I mean, I love music. I love music. You know, it's just part of my language. Oh!
my darling, I hungered for your touch alone.
Well, let's end our conversation as you end the movie with the real Elvis Presley. But I have to say, I found myself, I'm confessing here, getting Elvis for the first time.
Thank you.
Yeah. What do you think, I mean, what do you think that is, that thing, that humanity?
Yeah, you know what, Robin, you said the same word. A very, very, very well-known friend of mine, one of the great iconic hip-hop artists, I said, I need you as a friend to see the movie. He said, I don't expletive Elvis, basically, no. I said, but just see it. And he saw it. First of all, he said, first of all, who is that guy that acted Elvis? But secondly, he said, what you did. He said, you know what? I now get it. He's humanized him. And I think what it is, Robin, is it's like Marilyn Monroe. There comes a point in which they're there, they're sort of wallpaper. You sort of think you know them, but you don't. And my job was to find out for myself who he really was and what the journey really was. That is a great, almost three-act tragic opera.
Yeah. Baz Luhrmann, thank you so much.
Ray Robin, I enjoyed talking.
I'll be coming home.
That's footage of the real Elvis singing in Baz Luhrmann's new film, Elvis. Elvis would die shortly after at 42.
And time can do so much for you. Still God speed love to
today, St. Simon's Island, along the coast of Georgia, is a beautiful vacation getaway. But in 1803, Africans arriving there on a slave ship rose up and rebelled. Nellie Mendenhall of Georgia Public Broadcasting explains that rebellion has become a legend, the meaning of which is still being debated today. And a warning, this story contains references to suicide.
Dunbar Creek looks like any other tidal creek you might drive across on your way to the beach at St. Simon's Island. But this place is special. A new roadside historic marker only begins to explain why. It reads in part, in 1803, Igbo captives from West Africa revolted while on a slave ship. That's one history. Amy Mitchell Roberts knows another.
You had to go to people. Once I heard it.
Roberts is descended from enslaved people who worked this island, which means she's Gullah Geechee. She remembers a warning a childhood neighbor got from his mother about going down to Dunbar Creek.
You know, she wouldn't let her son go fishing down there because it was the end of the world.
The end of the world? Because once the 75 Igbo finished a three-month voyage from Africa to Georgia's coast?
They decided that this was not the life that they wanted. This was not what they bargained for.
So they took control of the ship and drove their captives into the water. But there were still men on shore waiting to force the Igbo onto plantations.
When the ship, a boat, stopped, they just walked over into the water.
What you believe happened next depends on what you or your ancestors needed from the story.
Even this story now has grown into something larger than what happened on that day.
That's Griffin Lotson, Amy's cousin and the vice chairman of the Gullah Geechee Cultural Heritage Commission. He remembers being told by his father that when the Igbo went into water, they didn't drown, they flew home.
And the Flying African stories come about because the only thing you had in your mind, like the Igbos, was being free.
Freedom was not on the mind of the Georgia planters after the incident. In a letter written not long after the rebellion, slave trader William Mines hid his sympathy for a white overseer. Poor fellow lost his life, Mines wrote. As for how Mines and others of his class felt about the 12 Igbo in the group that ultimately drowned.
These Africans are money to them. They are wealth to them.
That's Amir Jamal Touré, Gullah Geechee Fellow at Georgia Southern University. Touré says it's wrong to interpret what happened at the Igbo landing site as a mass suicide.
That's somebody else shaping the narrative.
Instead, he says, see the drowning as an act of resistance.
They're like saying that basically no man owns my soul. Only God owns my soul.
Bobby Anekwu says that's a story that's traveled the globe.
And it's called the first Freedom March in the United States.
Anekwu is an Atlanta attorney born in Nigeria. He's also a Ozo, or spiritual advisor, in the Igbo tradition. Anekwu and other leaders from Haiti, Brazil, and Barbados believe the souls of the rebel Igbo were still trapped in the water.
After all these years, they never left. They died a violent death.
So, in 2016, Anekwu and others performed a rite at Dunbar Creek called Ikwa Ozo, which means something like celebrating the dead. Their actions, that rite, fulfilled the words now written on the historic marker for the rebel Igbo, which Amy Mitchell Roberts has known all along.
The water brought us, and the water will take us away.
For NPR News, I'm Natalie Mendenhall in St. Simon's Island.
This Pride Month, we're celebrating the stories of LGBTQ plus folks from all walks of life, and that includes people of faith. Sadly, we've heard of many people who lost their connection to their religious communities after coming out. But what about those who find greater connections through their religious communities? That's the case with Eliana Rubin, a transgender Jewish activist and educator who uses theater and music to express herself and her tradition. Let's hear a little bit from her song, Badlands.
There's not a sound, nothing to crowd my thoughts, just silence. Under the skies, blue as your eyes, and there's no violence.
Eliana just received a master's degree from Hebrew Union College. Welcome to Here and Now, Eliana.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this is a fraught Pride Month in many ways. There are a lot of heavy things happening around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Much of that is associated with gender and sexual identity. But there's also been, especially over the past 10 years, a real celebration of queer life. And I wonder, what sort of bubbles up for you the most at this moment?
For me, what comes up is the idea of intersectionality, of intersecting identities within the LGBTQ plus community. I am a white transgender woman, and although my transness is part of a marginalized community, my whiteness, it has been favored over time, across time. And so I'm thinking about making sure that we are continuing to make our world more equitable for people of all members of the LGBTQ plus community, including those that have multiple marginalized identities, like Black, trans women, and trans people of color, and making sure that we are celebrating and also fighting for everyone that is a member of the queer and trans community.
You're both an educator and an activist within the Jewish community.
Mm-hmm.
How do you align your identity as a trans woman with the traditions of the Jewish faith?
Well, it's interesting for me because I realized that I wasn't cisgender, or I realized that my gender identity does not align with the sex that I was assigned at birth in a Jewish space.
Mm.
I work at the URJ Six Points Creative Arts Academy, which is a Reformed Jewish summer camp, and we focus on the creative arts. This summer, I'm actually returning as their artistic director, but in its first summer in 2018, I was hired to teach theater, and it was there that I learned that I wasn't cisgender because we put our names and our pronouns on name tags.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote down my birth name and he, him pronouns, and I labeled myself with that. And it was the act of physically labeling myself where I realized that that wasn't me anymore. And so that summer at this Jewish summer camp, I was really able to explore my gender identity in a way that I don't know if I would have been able to do so as freely if I wasn't in this space. And so within the context of my gender identity, my religion has always been at the forefront.
What aspects of the Jewish faith or even Jewish traditions challenge you and your work?
That's a great, I love that question, because those challenges are some of my favorite things to encounter within my work. I created something called Jewsicles or Jewish musicals, which are short musical numbers based off of Judaism's sacred texts. And I just did a concert of some of these Jewsicles last week at a synagogue that I had been working at for the past year as part of my studies at Hebrew Union College. And one of those Jewsicles was based on Leviticus 18:22, which is that very famous passage that talks about how if a man lies with another man, it is an abomination. And the Jewsicle that I wrote was from the perspective of someone speaking or singing, I suppose, to their same-sex lover. And the reason why I wanted to explore that was to kind of reclaim that narrative. The Jewsicle was also written for my thesis project at grad school, where I wrote a curriculum guide for high schoolers that teaches LGBTQ plus education terms and topics through Jewsicles. So using our sacred texts that may be challenging as a way to educate young people to say, actually, this is both normal and it is celebrated and beautiful is something that I think I really like to do with our challenging texts, is finding ways to reframe them to have them be part of the positive rhetoric as opposed to the negative.
Okay, well, this is not one of your Jewsicles, but it is a little bit more of your music. This is a little bit of your song, Lifetime.
I've been running around the corners of my mind, evading all these thoughts. They turn to demons on my shoulder, maybe.
There's a lot of yearning in that song.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's hope in there, but it's a hope that comes after work. Tell me a little bit about this song, how you came to write it.
Yeah, so I co-wrote this song with my co-writer and producer, Skylar Coco, who is a phenomenal queer musician and producer and singer-songwriter. And I wrote this song, we wrote this song after I had my heart broken by someone. And through this heartbreak, I was really questioning if I, as a trans person, am lovable in a romantic sense. It's something that I constantly battle with and something that I know is not true because I have been loved as a trans person. But when I was writing this song, I really wanted to both allow the truth to come out of the pain that came from this relationship while also making sure that the hope, like what you were saying, is still very prevalent. Because I think that with being a member of the LGBTQ plus community, hope has to exist in order to keep going. There are so many people out there that say that we shouldn't be allowed to exist or to love or to flourish. And sometimes that can become internalized. And that is a really awful feeling in my own experience. And so with the chorus of the song, talking about how I will find love in my lifetime, it's both a hopeful message and it's also a promise to myself that I will continue to search for love, even if that means that the love comes from me, because how can anyone else love me if I don't love myself?
As Pride Month comes to a close soon, my producer brought up this Jewish notion of tikkun olam. And one of the translations from the Hebrew is healing the earth. And there's a lot of different interpretations of what that means in the Jewish faith, and whether it's talking about just the earth itself or the living creatures and flora and fauna that's on it. I wonder how you interpret that tradition of healing into your work.
Yeah. It's up to us as individuals to figure out how we can repair our world. And sometimes that means that we work together and we're in a kihila kadosha or a holy or sacred community. And sometimes that means that we work on ourselves and we figure out how we can be better people on this earth, because it's both up to the collective and it's up to the individual to make sure that we are repairing the world at large and our own personal worlds.
So for the many people who are members of the LGBTQ plus community, you know, who may not be sure where the balance is tipping, whether mm-hmm. to feel anxious or this hope that you're talking about, mm-hmm. And also who may have broken away from their religious tradition mm-hmm. after they came out, mm-hmm. Either willingly or unwillingly, what would you say to those listening who are in that position?
I would say that you are valid. Your identities deserve to take up space. If you have stepped away from your religion because they have been unkind to your identities, that there are people out there, both in and out of religion, who want to celebrate you. I celebrate you. And you have to take care of yourself first. And if that means that you need to step away from a community for a bit in order to practice self-love and self-care, that's totally okay. And that, I love you, and there are a lot of people that love you, and that you are going to be okay.
That's Eliana Rubin, a transgender Jewish activist, educator, and musician. Thank you so much for joining us, and happy Pride.
Thank you for having me. Happy Pride.
It's like trying to tranquilize a raging grizzly bear with experimental drugs. That's how Atlantic staff writer Derek Thompson describes the path the Federal Reserve is taking to tame the economy. Raising interest rates, that's the tranquilizer, to reduce inflation, the bear, without also killing the bear and the economy. Now, we all know the impact of the inflated cost of things like gas and groceries. Last week, the Fed raised interest rates 0.75%, higher than predicted, to make it harder for Americans to borrow money or build credit card debt, and thus hopefully slow down their spending so there are more goods in circulation and prices come down, I think. But how is the bear? Let's bring in the Atlantic's Derek Thompson. He's with us by Skype. Derek, we're going to link to your writing, but have I got that metaphor even close?
I was actually just thinking, you are doing a fantastic job of describing that metaphor. Probably a better job than I did unpacking the metaphor in the original article. So kudos to you.
Well, okay, goodbye. No, let's continue. Because you say the signals we're getting from this economy are all over the place, completely confusing everyone, but also confusing the Fed. That's unnerving. Why do you say that?
I say it because the Federal Reserve, we think of as a bunch of oracle wizards that control monetary policy. And indeed, they are a bunch of people who control monetary policy. But in addition to having control over interest rates, they're also fundamentally just economic pundits. Mm-hmm. And when you listen to Fed Chair Jerome Powell be an economic pundit and try to do what it is I'm paid to do, explain the economy that he's looking at, I don't think he's doing a very good job of painting any kind of coherent picture. Mm. I hear him talking about how the labor market is partially responsible for inflation, but then also 2 seconds say that inflation's actually really being led by things like gas prices and energy and food prices, which have nothing to do with the American labor market. He says sometimes that the Fed can't fix these supply side issues, like the global supply of gas. And then 2 seconds later, say that they're desperately going to try to fix inflation by raising interest rates dramatically. You know, even if you support the path of interest rate increases the Federal Reserve is approaching, I don't think he's doing a very good job of explaining what this economy is and how he sees it.
Well, in fact, let's listen. Last week, after the Fed raised those interest rates 0.75%, Fed Chair Jerome Powell did tell reporters, outside forces are beyond the Fed's control. Let's listen.
Commodity prices, the war in Ukraine, supply chain, things like that, where we really can't, the monetary policy stance doesn't affect those things. The thing is, you don't know whether those forces are, to what extent are they going to be sustained.
It sounds like, Derek, you're saying that he's also said the opposite, that maybe he can do something about supply chains. But isn't it true that the Fed, well, you know, their most important lever is interest rates. Is that the only one?
No, I like to think of the Fed as really having two different levers. One lever is action, that's the interest rate, and the other lever is language. People will respond in terms of their own economic activity to what they think the Fed is going to do in the future. And so again, this is rather confusing. The Fed said it was going to raise interest rates 0.5 percentage points, and then at the very last minute leaked to the Wall Street Journal and other Fed watchers that they were going to raise interest rates by 0.75 percentage points. That's a pretty, that's a big increase. That's a 50% increase over what they said they were going to do. And so I think that surprised some people. It made some people think that the Fed is much more afraid of inflation than they were just 2-3 weeks ago. But again, the reason why they were more afraid of inflation, I think, is a little bit confusing. They mentioned that their interest rate expectations of people, according to one University of Michigan survey, went up, and that's certainly true. But core inflation in the last inflation report has actually been going down the last few months. So I just think that the Federal Reserve overall is not doing a very good job of consistently understanding, consistently communicating, and consistently predicting what's going to happen in this economy.
Well, and you say they've set it up so that good news will be bad news. I mean, in other words, if people are out there spending and, you know, feeling good about the economy, that's bad because they are then driving up prices because then there's fewer goods for people to buy. What, look, you are a pundit, but make believe for just the minute we have, you are the Fed chair. What do you think he should be saying?
Well, I don't think the Federal Reserve should be raising interest rates by 0.75 percentage points, to be honest. I think they probably overreacted to the latest inflation reports. I agree with the clip that you played of Jerome Powell saying that many of the contributors to U.S. inflation are about global supply chains that monetary policy in the U.S. has very little immediate control over. And as a result, I would raise rates consistently. I'd raise rates by a much lower amount that they're raising them. And I would also just keep my eye on the fact that there's all sorts of things happening around the world that are responsible for rising energy and food prices that the Federal Reserve doesn't really control. So that's really the story that I would tell, is that we are in an environment where demand in the U.S. is hot. It's probably going to cool down. You haven't had stimulus packages passed in the last few months or quarters. A lot of people's savings rates have been drawn down because they've been spending that which they got from the federal government the last few years. I think that U.S. demand is probably going to stabilize, and what we're left with are energy imbalances that just aren't really responsive to interest rate increases.
There you go. Derek Thompson, staff writer for The Atlantic. Again, we'll link you at hereandnow.org. There's a grizzly bear in there as well this time. Derek, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young in Boston.
And I'm Celeste Headlee in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now.